Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
The new tools that a metaverse can bring allows you to create more immersive content.
Companies are beginning to sell less oil, more electrons.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
The supply chain breakdown is combining with labor shortages.
Will Eastern manufacturers continue to dominate, or will there be a renewed interest in Western manufacturers?
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and global markets with in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide. Coming up today, the path ahead for Amazon after a disappointing quarter, plus what to watch out for in Best Buy earnings, and what Berkshire Hathaway's spending spree tells us about Warren Buffett's outlook. We start today's program with Amazon. The retail giant reported first quarter earnings that fell short of expectations, but it's not all doom and gloom for the brainchild of Jeff Bezos. Bloomberg Intelligence senior retail analyst Poonam Goyal covers the company and joins us now. Poonam, thanks so much for joining us. I'd love for you to just kind of recap what happened on the recent earnings release, because it really drove the stock down significantly.
Yeah, I think the biggest issue with the release and what they reported was margin. They're facing higher costs, and that's across their online business. So when you think of Amazon, you know, they've invested a lot in logistics, they've invested a lot in wages, and that all plus compounding inflation is resulting in them having to see an extra $6 billion in costs for the upcoming quarter. Outside of that, I mean, look, while, you know, the stock was down a lot, if you look at what went right at Amazon, because I do think there's still a lot going right for them. AWS was a huge hit.
That's their cloud business, right?
Yeah, that's their cloud business. They reached record profit margins, surpassing 35%. And they had 37% growth on the revenue side. Very, very good. The advertising business was up north of 20%. And these are all higher margin businesses. So I think where they're investing is still helping them to grow the business and find room to expand the online business. But the online business is challenged from a profit side, not a revenue side. So this is not a sign that Amazon is seeing less demand. It is absolutely not that. It is more that costs are rising and they invested a little too much during COVID. So now they have the opportunity to pull back a little and let volume rise to offset those growing costs for a year or two.
So it's interesting. This is a company and this is a stock that has just always fascinated me, because this is Jeff Bezos has basically told the market, I'm going to spend whatever I need to spend to develop my leading position in the markets I want to be in. So if you're looking for near-term profits, Amazon.com might not be the stock for you. And that basically worked for a decade or so. But I guess investors have gotten used to some of these profits that the cloud business has been throwing off. And they definitely took a somber tone when they saw that kind of cost guidance.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. For a long time, it didn't matter if Amazon made money or not, right? It didn't matter. But it's mattering more, not just for Amazon, but across like tech retail companies. Profits have become a larger part of the investment thesis, where investors are rewarding companies with better profitability and not just good top line. But that said, the cloud business contributes on average over the last 3 years, 66% of Amazon's total operating profit. So a big, big amount there. And we think that the cloud business will only get even more profitable. So originally, we had thought that 35% margins were kind of where they were going. But now we think 40% is possible. And that's really due to just an expansion into higher margin services that generate 80% profit margin versus right now the infrastructure as a service is around 40% profit margin.
I know that the cloud business is just one of the best and biggest growth areas within the tech stack, broadly defined, and Amazon's got a great position. Talk to me about the competitive landscape there. How is Amazon positioned?
Yeah, Amazon's the leader in it. So Amazon is the leader in the cloud business, but it doesn't mean that it has to take share from the other players. The entire cloud business can grow where everyone can get a piece of it, but we think Amazon will retain its lead over time.
You mentioned the advertising business, and that's kind of been a relatively new business for Amazon, and it's been kind of the, I guess, the domain. You think about digital advertising, you think about Google, you think about Facebook, but now Amazon's becoming a player here. How big do you think they can be, want to be, are willing to invest to be?
They started disclosing their advertising business just, you know, maybe a quarter or two ago, and its run rate is about $40 to $50 billion a year. Small still, we think, but pretty sizable. I mean, I wouldn't have thought it was that big until they started reporting the numbers. So I think they can continue to grow share in that. What we're hearing is that companies are shifting in the way that they advertise because of the way consumers are spending and where the eyeballs are. And I think Amazon has a good platform for it to attract some of those shifting dollars. So we think advertising is still a great growth vehicle for them that can continue to grow, you know, 15 to 20% or even more, really, for the next several years.
You know, I'm looking at the ANR function on the Bloomberg terminal here for Amazon.com. 58 buys from Wall Street Research, one hold and one sell. So the sell side is still on board the Amazon train. What do you think investors, what do you think the market needs to see? Is this kind of like a show me stock? Show me you can get control over your expenses?
Yeah, I think for now, yes. It definitely is. And remember, the $6 billion in incremental costs that they're about to face, $4 billion of it is just really excess capacity. So they hired a lot of people during COVID because people were calling out sick. And now everyone's back, right, to the workforce. They build a lot of capacity to support growing online orders, but now they have excess capacity because growth has slowed in the online business off of tougher comparisons. But as Amazon continues to gain volume, typically this year you'd see Amazon hire, you know, several 20, 30, 40, 50, even 100,000 people right through the holidays. That may not happen this year because they have excess workers in the distribution centers. So it just takes time for them to cycle that and kind of normalize their cost base on that front. On the inflation side, the $2 billion part of it, that I think will continue to be a pain point for Amazon, but that's across the board. Amazon's not alone to that.
All right, good stuff there on Amazon.com. Our thanks to Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Retail Analyst Poonam Goyal. Up next on the program, earnings from Best Buy and the big box retailer break out of its multi-year slump. That's straight ahead on Bloomberg Intelligence, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Thanks for joining us for another edition of Bloomberg Intelligence, where we look at the big business stories impacting Wall Street and global markets. Let's talk big box retail now and the path ahead for Best Buy as the electronics retailer prepares to report earnings. Lindsay Dutch covers a company for Bloomberg Intelligence and joins us now. Lindsay, give us a sense here. We're going to start hearing from some of the big retailers here. How about for Best Buy? How's that business looking?
So this year is looking a little bit challenging for Best Buy just in general. You know, they had a phenomenal 2020 and a 2021, you know, with everybody working from home and needing to kind of beef up their home electronic setup. and all of that. And so this year, there could be a slight pullback in demand. So we think that guidance, which is projecting about a 3% sales decline in the year, could be a little bit on the conservative side, as people still do need to continue to upgrade their systems and their electronics, and that demand could remain a little bit more resilient than they're expecting.
Interesting. Now, inflation obviously is a key issue for this economy. It's a key issue for a lot of industries in particular. What are you seeing from your retailers? Are they able to pass along price increases like at Best Buy?
Yeah, so inflation is going to be a pressure point this year. One advantage is that Best Buy does have a pretty wide assortment of products. So, you know, if you're looking at a new laptop, you might be able to trade down a little bit to fit your budget a little bit better. I think in general, Best Buy's strategy is to remain price competitive. So we have not seen or heard them discuss raising prices to sort of offset higher costs at this point yet. But we will hear from them when they report earnings in late May.
All right, let's talk about like the supply chain, another big issue that really has come to the fore over the last couple of years. Talk about how Best Buy has been dealing with that. If I actually go to a Best Buy store this weekend to buy the latest gadget, is it going to be on the shelf?
Yeah, so their inventory levels have been pretty good, pretty solid. You know, they feel confident, you know, heading into the back half of the year that they're going to have the inventory that they need, you know, given that they really sell the vast majority of their products in that back half. I think one thing that's unique and interesting about Best Buy is how that they fulfill a lot of their orders, particularly online. So they get like 30 to 40% of their sales come online, but they fulfill a very large percent, 60 to 70% directly from a store. That means curbside pickup, that means shipped to your house, but also they have employees doing delivery. So I think that does help them in, you know, it's a unique angle that many other retailers don't really use.
How about labor? A lot of consumer facing businesses, you know, whether it's a restaurant or anything, they're really facing a hard time getting people to actually work. What's Best Buy seeing out there?
Best Buy sees similar challenges. You know, I think some things that they're working on is, you know, really creating career development opportunities. You know, they have their employees trained to be specialists in different areas, and they have, you know, like multiple different sort of silos that an employee can grow into. And I think that they sort of use that, you know, long-term career type growth path to help. They also do, you know, make sure that they're keeping up with wages and things of that nature.
You know, I'm just wondering, think about some of these electronic items. They can be pretty big ticket items. We've got rising interest rates. We've got an economy that is slowing, arguably. So that brings into question stagflation as a risk out there in the marketplace. And what's the company saying at Best Buy about how they see the consumer, how they see demand?
I really think that the management team at Best Buy is expecting sort of a pullback this year, you know, for all of the challenges and the pressures that you're mentioning. You know, so they're forecasting about a 3% decrease in sales for the year. We won't really see that, I don't think, until closer to the second half, you know, when they really earn over half of their revenue. But I agree, there's going to be pressure on big ticket items. You know, they sell one in every three TVs, computers, and laptops.
Wow.
So they have a big market share with those big ticket items in particular. They're trying to expand assortment sort of on the smaller sort of purchases, but they just don't have the share there. So, you know, a big pullback in the consumer, you know, not spending on those big ticket items will certainly show in the results in the second half of the year.
I'm looking at the ANR function on the Bloomberg terminal for analyst recommendations. 13 buys, 12 holds, and 2 sells. So the street's really split on this name. What do you think is the one or two issues that the streets maybe can't come to consensus on?
Yeah, so I think that they had, you know, a phenomenal past couple of years. And, you know, the management team has set out pretty aggressive goals to reach in the next 3 years. You know, they want to grow revenue about 6% from last year's peak, and they want to increase margin, you know, above 6%, which would be, you know, better than Amazon or Walmart. So they have some aggressive goals. And I think, you know, in the beginning of the year, you know, some analysts got excited about those goals. But then I think that there's a growing concern of perhaps, you know, difficulty reaching them. I think they can reach some of the goals, but I think the key is really creating loyalty. Best Buy has so many different products that I think many of us are not aware of, and they need to use their service and the fact that they have storefronts, which is really their differentiators, to convert people to be customers and not only buy a TV, but buy many other products from them. And that is really, to me, the long-term opportunity for Best Buy. But the company has also made a remarkable transformation. When you think back several years, I mean, they are basically the only surviving public company in the electronics space.
So who is the competition then? Is it the Walmarts? Is it the Amazons of the world?
Yes. So it really depends. You know, like when you think about appliances, obviously Lowe's and Home Depot are big competitors. You know, you have Amazon, on smaller electronics. You know, have the mass merchants Target and Walmart there too. So really that's why I think the differentiator is that service arm. They are expanding into healthcare, which I think could be a really unique edge for them. Particularly, they're going into sort of active aging, and that really marries, you know, their expertise in electronics and allowing people to kind of live in their home a lot longer. So that could be a unique opportunity over the longer term.
All right, interesting stuff. I'm just looking at the stock down about 7% year to date. That's kind of in line with what you would expect when you've got Wall Street pretty split on this name. Not really sure what to do with it at this point. Our thanks to Bloomberg Intelligence analyst Lindsay Dutch. Coming up on the program, we take a look inside the mind of Warren Buffett. Find out what Berkshire Hathaway's spending spree may tell us about Buffett's outlook. That's straight ahead on Bloomberg Intelligence, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BIGO on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney, and it's 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Thanks for joining us on Bloomberg Intelligence. We're here each and every week tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analyst covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide. The next company on our list today needs no introduction. Let's talk Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway and what the company's earnings last week say about its outlook. Insurance is a big part of Berkshire's portfolio, of course. Matthew Palazzola covers the insurance industry for Bloomberg Intelligence and joins us now. Matthew, thanks so much for joining us. You were out in Omaha a couple weeks ago for this Investor Day, which I guess they haven't done it in a couple of years because of the pandemic. Tell us about what it's like to go to one of these, you know, Warren Buffett events.
So it's an interesting experience, Paul. I have not been there before. It's a big Warren Buffett, Berkshire Hathaway love fest. I think the investor base there is a lot of retail investors. There's a big shopping component to it.
Okay. So what are some of the messages you took out of Omaha? I mean, where is he putting the money? That, you know, it's interesting. I saw that he took a big stake in Activision. That one surprised me because when I think of Warren Buffett, I don't think of gaming.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to see him at the arcade, but it was really just an arbitrage play. He, one of his investment deputies actually took a position in it before the Microsoft bid.
Okay.
And he then, I guess, looked at it a little more closely and evaluated the deal. He thinks it's going to go through. So he just sees it kind of as free money.
Where else besides gaming? I think Chevron popped up as another investment where they're putting some capital to work.
So what he did was it was very interesting. They put a lot of money to work in the quarter. It's $41 billion of net equity purchases in the quarter. And about half of that was in Chevron. And going into the quarter, we had said, you know, look, inflation's coming. Maybe he's a little afraid of that. And, you know, maybe he would buy some sort of inflation hedges. And it looked like he did put that money to work in inflation hedge in an energy stock.
Still over $100 billion, as I understand it, kind of on the books. That's cash that can be invested. Any hint did you glean from this event about where they may be looking?
They're pretty cagey about where they're going. They actually bought more Apple as well.
Okay.
So they tend to stick to their knitting. He didn't really give any clue as to what they're doing. I would definitely think things they're used to, energy, stocks they're used to, but he keeps it close to the vest.
They still have the big stake in which railroad is it?
Burlington Northern. That's one of their biggest businesses.
That's one of their biggest businesses. Okay. Mm-hmm. People love get Buffett's take on the economy, take on interest rates. Did he talk about inflation? Because that's certainly the big, big topic that corporate America is dealing with and consumers are dealing with.
It was less of a topic than I thought it was going to be because they take questions from retail investors.
Okay.
I don't think they got a lot. He got one or two, but he basically will say, inflation, I don't know where it's going to be. You know, we're kind of positioning. I think a lot more goes on behind the scenes than he lets on.
Activision's one thing. The other big topic, or another huge topic in the financial markets, is just crypto, broadly defined, Bitcoin, however you want to play it. I can't imagine Warren Buffett and the folks at Berkshire Hathaway have much appetite for crypto. Has he ever talked about what he thinks about that whole space?
So him and Vice Chairman Charlie Munger are kind of notoriously anti-crypto. I believe they called it rat poison squared in the past. he had a great analogy, which I thought, and you know, don't send me the hate mail, crypto people, but he had said, if you could take $50 billion and buy 1% of the farms in the country, or 1-2% of the apartment buildings in the country, or you could buy all of the crypto or all of the Bitcoin, what would you want to hold? You could hold productive assets, or you could hold something that you just hope someone's going to pay you more money for. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a great rationale, and you will not be seeing them in the crypto markets anytime soon.
Interesting. How about succession here? I mean, Warren is 92 or
two.
Something.
Yep.
And Charlie Munger is 98, I believe.
97.
97. Okay, I don't want to go too far there. So, I mean, it's been a topic for at least a decade. Did you get any more color?
Yeah. So last year at the annual meeting, they actually kind of let it slip that Greg Abel, who is the head of all non-insurance operations, he came from the energy side, that he's essentially the successor. The plan could change, but Greg right now would take over if Warren Buffett left tomorrow. And he was at the meeting. He was at the floor. I actually got to say hi to him. He took part in the presentation part of the meeting, but he only really answered one question.
So is there any reason to believe, based upon kind of what we know about this guy, that he would materially change the kind of investment thesis that Warren Buffett's had, which is I can only buy stuff that I really understand, like, you know, railroads?
I don't think he will change it. A big part of the meeting was a talk about culture. And they talked about having the financial strength and having the board that would essentially resist anyone internally or externally trying to change the culture. I had wrote a while ago about how he had said Abel has Berkshire in his blood. So I think he's very comfortable with Abel continuing on. He did say that Greg would probably face a little more board scrutiny in larger deals. He doesn't have the, he wouldn't have get the the Buffett discount, but that's really about it.
Will they ever pay a dividend, Berkshire Hathaway?
I think that's one of those things that's going to be over Warren Buffett's dead body. I think Greg Abel might be amenable to it in the future. Maybe that's his way of putting his stamp on the company, but that's not something you're going to see until Buffett's out of the picture.
All right, good stuff. Our thanks to Bloomberg Intelligence analyst Matthew Palazzola. Up next on the program, we love to talk big banks, but how about the smaller guys? We'll tell you why a trend in regional bank earnings could be a cause for concern. That's straight ahead on Bloomberg Intelligence, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies in 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BIGO on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Thanks for joining for another edition of Bloomberg Intelligence, where we look at the big business stories impacting Wall Street and global markets. Up next, let's head overseas for a look at housing in Britain. The UK housing market has been robust, but can the momentum continue? To answer that question, we bring in Bloomberg Intelligence real estate analyst Ivana Hovenko. Ivana, thanks so much for joining us here. I'd love to get kind of a 30,000-foot overview of the UK market, because here in the US, it's been red hot really since, for a long time, but certainly during the beginning of the pandemic. Give us a sense of how the UK real estate market is.
Yeah, so UK housing market has also been really, really robust. since the pandemic began, and actually literally defying expectations of many analysts. And it has been expected to slow down, actually, since the middle of that last year when the stamp duty holiday, so that's the purchase tax for buyers. Since the stamp duty holiday was being tapered or withdrawn completely from September, basically a lot of analysts expected the market to slow down, but none of that has happened. Actually, the market continues very, very strongly and continues to defy expectations. And actually, at the beginning of the year, we've had analysis for example, Zoopla that says actually demand has started even stronger at the beginning of this year than what it was in the previous 2 years. Meanwhile, we also have a massive squeeze of supply. There aren't enough homes versus much bigger demand. So this gap is actually very, very robust, and this is fueling house prices.
One of the concerns, potentially the headwinds that I've heard here in the States, is interest rates are rising, and that's a global story, and mortgage rates are going up.
It is.
So what do the builders kind of say about that sensitivity?
So yes, interest rates are rising, but especially in comparison with the US, what will probably surprise you is that you can still get 90% LTV mortgages for first-time buyers. So these are the buyers with less credit history, less established in the credit market, and you for less than 2.5%.
Wow,
that's the mortgage rate.
Is that rate subsidized by the government?
No, this is the market rate actually.
Wow. Okay.
So actually, there are the subsidized rates. There are also some other rates for help to buy, where the buyers get a 20% deposit from the government. So that's outside of London. And that's interest-free for 5 years. And in London, it's 40%. So actually, those rates would be even lower.
You know, you mentioned a supply of new housing. And here in the States, what I've heard from real estate people for the longest time is that, yeah, the home builders are building houses, but they're building the big houses, the McMansions, where they can get a real big profit margin. They're not necessarily buying entry-level supply of housing. That is changing here in the U.S. Where is it in terms of new housing construction in the U.K.? Where are you guys?
I would say that actually, I think we spoke about it in the past, that actually this is where the U.S. market is slightly different from the U.K. Actually, majority of the home builders are actually focused on the entry-level home, so the first-time buyer, first-time mover. And actually, the larger homes would constitute a smaller proportion of their sales. So it's less of that. And actually, this has been supported by the government policy with help to buy, a lot of incentives for the sort of entry-level housing. And demand is there because people prefer to, it's cheaper to buy versus renting.
Hey, Vonna, you know, I wonder if there's any regionality to the housing market in the UK, because here in the States, it just seems like everybody's moving to Florida. Everybody's moving to Austin, Texas, and things like that, you know, saying goodbye, to New York City and San Francisco. Are you seeing any regional bias like that in the UK?
Yes, we do have that as well. London has been the laggard of the UK housing market. However, with the reopening, and actually we've had much bigger reopening, much bigger easing than the rest of Europe. So the London market is now picking up. That said, it's probably a similar story. So the more affordable markets and the markets with a bit more scenic places like Wales for example, in terms of affordability, that would be the northwest of the UK, so around Manchester, Liverpool, etc. These places have been growing absolutely the fastest, as well as southwest, which is where, for example, Cornwall is. So a lot of people would like to have their second home there.
You know, the last time I was in London, which admittedly was right before the pandemic, so a little more than 2 years ago, it just seemed like there was a building crane on every single street in London. Is that residential as well as commercial?
I would say it's more of commercial.
Okay.
I think from the commentaries from the big home builders is that actually the land prices, the value isn't quite, like, it's been more difficult in central London to build. And some of them, like, for example, Taylor Wimby, they said that actually we are finding more value in the suburbs. So actually focusing on the original London population who don't maybe are looking for more of family houses, slightly more related to the local earnings. I would say inner London, commercial, outer, it's actually where the home builders are and new residential construction is actually in outer London.
Our thanks to Bloomberg Intelligence real estate analyst Ivana Hovenko, always interested in her thoughts on the UK housing market. Up next, let's take a look at the small guys in the banking sector. We're talking regional banks and declines in their tangible book that should not be dismissed. Here at details on that is Bloomberg Intelligence senior bank analyst Herman Chan. Herman, thanks so much for joining us here. Talk to us. I mean, we've already had the big money center banks report their numbers. Okay, I thought they were okay, but the market was a little disappointed. Talk to us about the regional banks, because when I think regional banks, I think loan demand, I think net interest income. I'm not worried about so much global trading of FX.
That's right. Regional banks are more focused on Main Street, meaning loan growth, deposit growth, interest rates. But just stepping it back here and thinking about banks in general, when I analyze banks and when I talk to investors that invest in banks, it's really a case of slow and steady winning the race, meaning banks that grow their balance sheets via loans and deposits at a measured pace and effectively managing credit risk, meaning low loan defaults. This often leads to growth in tangible book value, a key measure of value creation for banks. What we saw in the first quarter earnings for the regionals is that managing interest rate risk is also a key factor in value creation, as tangible book value actually fell 9% at the median for the regional banks that we cover. That decline is due to the mark-to-market nature of bank securities portfolios, as rising rates has led to lower valuations of these holdings. What's interesting to me is that a handful of banks that were able to actually grow tangible book in the face of these declines in securities or keep them relatively steady. So we're talking about banks like First Republic, SVB in San Francisco, M&T Bank in Buffalo, and Signature Bank here in New York City. These banks have demonstrated some more prudent management of interest rate risk, with tangible book value serving as an anchor for valuation in the current pessimistic backdrop due to recessionary fears.
So I know we've got interest rates rising, and they're going to continue to rise throughout the year. That's what our Federal Reserve is saying. There is some concern that maybe they go too far too fast and push this economy into recession, or at the very least, kind of stagnant growth, bringing on that word stagflation. How do regional banks typically perform in that environment?
Yeah, so it's a tale of two cities here. So you've got rising interest rates, which is positive for net interest income and net interest margin. So you're going to see really strong revenue growth for all the banks that we cover. Consensus is baking in about 13% revenue growth for 2022 versus last year. So really strong revenue gains, in large part due to higher rates and also due to loan growth. On the other hand, the potential for recession and stagflation is deeply in the minds of investors, and banks don't really get the benefit of the doubt in these periods of uncertainty. So you've seen strong pullback in bank stocks over the past 3 months or so, given the fact that the potential for higher net charge-offs could overwhelm the revenue gains potentially in 2023.
Talk to us about that loan growth that you were mentioning, because that's a big part of it. You think about a regional bank, you think about them making loans to small and mid-sized businesses in their geography, the real lifeblood of the American economy. But for a while there, companies weren't borrowing money because the government was giving it to them. So give us a sense of loan growth here.
During the pandemic period, Paycheck Protection Program, the PPP, was a big factor in keeping a lot of these companies afloat. And the regional banks participated in that in generating these loans. In last year, particularly in the back half and in the first quarter of this year, you've seen those PPP loans being forgiven. So that's been a headwind for loan growth. Fortunately, over the past couple quarters, banks have been able to generate growth outside of PPP from commercial lending, and banks have cited inventory building, M&A, working capital needs as factors that have helped grow their commercial lending balances. And that looks to set to continue, which would be a positive for loan growth throughout the regional banking space.
All right, I got to talk about M&A because that's always a fun area for the regional bank business. Where are we in terms of M&A in a regional bank business? It seems a little quiet, I guess, recently over the last 6 to 12 months. Where are we? How are people thinking about it?
M&A has slowed a little bit. We've had some delays in regulatory approvals for a number of deals. the M&T deal for Peoples had been delayed. There was a CIT deal with for Citizens that was delayed for a while. So there's been some uncertainty in closing these deals in a fashion that makes sense for both acquirers and sellers. So that's weighed on volumes. We've also, given the fact that M&A has been pretty robust over the past couple of years, a lot of the banks have conducted M&A are still sort of digesting their deals. So it'll take some time for them to get their house in order before they do additional deal making.
Good stuff. As always, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Bank Analyst Herman Chan. It's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on their terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.